I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Citigroup says it will listen, but will Wall Street? Now that shareholders at Citigroup have become the first at a major Wall Street firm to vote to reject executive pay under the Dodd-Frank financial bill, which calls for a say-on-pay vote every 3 years. But that vote is non-binding. So how is Wall Street reacting? Let's bring in Joanne Lublin. She's management news editor for The Wall Street Journal. Joanne, this was the pay package for Citigroup CEO Vikram Pandit, but also other executives. What did shareholders, and by the way, they included groups like the California and Florida public worker pension systems. What did they say?
Well, this was what's called a say-on-pay vote, okay? It's an advisory vote. It doesn't force the company to do anything, but it does send a clear wake-up call to the board at Citigroup that shareholders are not happy that the company's performance has not kept pace with the pay that the top executives are getting.
I guess that's the question. Does it send a clear signal? Because, as you said, it's non-binding. The Citigroup chair says the shareholder vote is a serious matter. But, you know, do they really have to do anything about it or because of it?
Well, what they do have to do about it, and that's part of the law, too, is come back in their proxy statement next year before next year's annual meeting and tell their shareholders, here's what we did in reaction to your vote last year on our pay practices. They have to describe corrective actions, how they perhaps reached out to shareholders, found out what were the reasons that they said thumbs down on the pay package for the top brass. And they have to make a really good faith effort to try and get them back on their good side. We saw that already happen so far this year with a number of companies who either lost their say-on-pay vote last year or saw it narrowly get approved. They came back in their proxy statements this year and said, okay, we heard you.
Well, and some of the companies, actually, there's only three besides Citi this year, KB Home, International Game Technology, Inc., and Actuant Corp. They failed to get that shareholders' approval. Last year, 41 companies failed. Did we see any of those outcomes that you just spoke of? Did we see boards come back?
Yes, and in a number of those cases, especially those who had squeaky narrow victories or saw thumbs down on the say-on-pay vote, I've seen a number of companies changing their pay practices. They're putting in more bells and whistles. You can't just get the money for showing up for work. You actually have to perform. They're getting rid of what some shareholders consider to be outrageous perks, you know, getting to fly on the corporate jet for everything, even your golfing vacation. They're putting in better, you know, governance practices in some cases as a result of some of these votes to make it easier for shareholders to say, we don't like the directors. So they're doing, some of them are going to annual election of directors rather than every 3 or 4 years. What better way to let the board know you don't like what they're doing on pay than by voting against them?
Well, it's funny you mentioned corporate jets. Brian Magori, a columnist here at the Boston Globe, writes today about tracking down the jets of Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. And he did that through a Wall Street Journal website called WSJ Jet Tracker that tracks the flights of these corporate jets. And many of them are going to the vacation homes of the CEOs. But Exile on Wall Street author Mike Mayo says that Citigroup is one of the most egregious examples of disconnect between the incentives of top management and the value creation of shareholders. I mean, this idea that shareholders want to see something for these pay packages. But in just the minute we have, is the board of directors tone deaf? Do they not hear these rumblings?
I think in this case, the board thinks that they did the right thing because in the case of Mr. Pandit, he had earned a dollar a year for salary for 2 years when things were going pretty badly for the company, and that they have repaid their federal loans and they're on the comeback trail. But clearly, if they weren't tone deaf, they were at least a little hard of hearing in not doing enough of an outreach ahead of their annual meeting to see how their institutional shareholders were reacting to these recommendations from these two proxy advisory firms.
And as we have heard in the past, very often a problem is that the board, they were appointed by some of these CEOs. So that's probably going to be looked at as well. Joanne Lublin, management news editor for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we've heard for a long time the concern of American businesses about China stealing their technology. The director of the National Security Agency now says China's industrial espionage program is the greatest transfer of wealth in history. Case in point, the Massachusetts-based American Superconductor Corporation, or AMSC. They design software that makes turbines run. They partnered with the Chinese company Sinovel Wind Group to build the turbines. Then last year, a semi-trailer of ASMC electronic components that had been ordered by Sinovel were turned away at the gate to a Sinovel factory. The factory didn't need them because they were making their own with stolen technology, erasing 40% of the American company's value in one day. Now AMSC is suing Sinovel in China for a total of $1.2 billion for breach of contract, copyright infringement, and theft of trade secrets. It's a fascinating story, and Michael Riley tells it in Bloomberg. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit more about how this was discovered. It's how your story begins. You had AMSC American technicians in the Gobi Desert crawling into a wind turbine in China trying to figure out, you know, why it's not working the way they want it to, and what do they find?
The funny thing about this particular turbine is it was a test turbine, and it was running code made by American Superconductor, and that code had a clock on it that was supposed to shut off the turbine after a test period. So the fact that the turbine was running was strange. They opened the turbine door at the base of it, and they climbed 230 feet to the top. It's quite a climb. It's exhausting. They upload the code that's inside, and they send that code to Austria, which is where the company's research lab is based. What they find is that, in fact, the turbine was running a version of the code that had been altered. They could tell that somebody within the lab had actually done the altering of the code. They find that somebody who had worked for American Superconductor in that lab had sold, effectively, for a pretty large bribe, the source code, which was the keys to basically that technology.
Okay, so now we are deep into this John le Carré novel. You know, it just is, it's an amazing story. You've already taken us from China to Austria. The reason some of this technology was in Austria is that American Superconductor CEO Daniel McGahn wasn't a stranger to doing business in Asia or to the dangers of dealing with Chinese companies. He'd taken incredible precautions. What are some of the things that he did?
That's one of the fascinating things about this story. American Superconductor started in the 80s by four Massachusetts Institute of Technology professors. It was based around a certain technology, superconducting material. It never really made a profit. So when McGahn was brought in, he basically looked around and saw that one aspect of the business was building effectively the brains of wind turbines. He looked at China. You could see that China's wind market was about to take off. They had passed a green energy law that mandated a certain level of energy production from renewable sources. It has turned China into the hottest wind market on the globe.
Well, in fact, you note that in 2009, and you cite a U.S. wind industry report, a new turbine was going up in China every hour.
Yes, that's right. It's actually a pretty incredible market there. McGahn basically architected AMSC to try and take advantage of that, partnering with Chinese companies. He knew that this was going to be a risky venture, though. Chinese companies are known for trying to cut out their foreign partners after a certain time, often using technology transfer agreements. So he set up the company in a way to protect its most valuable secrets, which is effectively the technology, especially the source code.
Yeah.
He basically made sure that the high-value technology was made in either the facility in Austria or in facilities in the United States and shipped into a China facility. For the first 40 employees, he interviewed about 400 people himself. He was looking for people that he could trust. So he did. They took a lot of time and a lot of care to create a system where they would be insulated from theft.
Well, except you could do all of this, isolate your servers in Austria, but then people enter the picture. And it turns out, as you say, that there was one employee that couldn't resist a bribe. This was a Serbian software engineer who worked in the facility in Austria. But make the connection. What happened? How did China get in touch with him?
So this particular employee was a key employee in the research center that made a lot of the code, again, that creates the brains for these wind turbines. His name was Dejan Karabasevich. He had a lot of contact with American Superconductor's partners in China. He would spend a lot of time in China. And as he describes in his confession, at some point, Sinovel and its employees begin to court him. They talk to him about how hard he works. They want to make sure that he's taken care of. Is his salary big enough? And they slowly, over a process, get to the point where they offer him a job and about $1.6 million for what would effectively be a consulting job over 5 or 6 years. The catch, though, is that they basically implicitly or explicitly wanted him to bring with them the secrets to American superconductors technology, which they could use to basically make these parts, these key parts of the wind turbine themselves.
Corporations are always courting other people, hoping to get some inside baseball or contacts and things like that. But in this case, once they had the technology, they're building things themselves, and you paint the scene of tractor trailers literally pulling up with the equipment that had been ordered, and it's being turned away because Sinovel already has it. It's pretty, I mean, as you say, faces turned white as ghosts and hearts dropped because they knew, the American company knew what had happened.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that makes this a little more dramatic is that Dan McGann's plan had actually worked out really well. American Superconductor had grown quickly, had grown quite profitably, but had done it basically through a partnership with one customer, and that customer was Sinovel. By the time the theft was uncovered, Sinovel represented about 70% of the total revenues of this American company. McGann now recognizes and will admit that they had a customer, what Wall Street calls a customer concentration problem, relying too much on one particular customer. So when Sinovel stops paying them for shipments, they're trying to work out this dispute. They keep sending things. And then at late March of last year, when the semi-truck load of components shows up at the gates, the guards come out and essentially say, you know what, we're not taking this stuff. That becomes a huge problem. They have to make an announcement to the market. Their shares drop dramatically. And that begins the process where they finally discover what was actually going on.
There's no question that this happened. There are email trails showing that China courted the employee and then paid him to, you know, help with stealing the code. So there's no question about that. But what? You now have AMSC deciding to sue Sinovel in Chinese courts. Is there any sense that anything will come of that?
There's definitely a home field advantage for Sinovel, and some of the investors in it are connected to the highest levels of China's leadership now. There is a possible twist here, though. You have to keep in mind that this comes in the context where there are rising chorus of voices suggesting that China does this on a large scale. There's a report issued last year by a collection of 14 U.S. intelligence agencies that said that the theft of intellectual property from American and European companies had essentially become part of the economic model of China. Mm. The theft of intellectual property is a historical phenomenon. America did it during the Industrial Revolution. They would send people into British factories, and they'd make drawings, and they'd come back, and they'd recreate the machinery there. What's different about this is that China is a bit of a luck of timing. China is trying to sort of advance its economy to a level of the strongest and most innovative in the world at a time when everything is on a server somewhere. Basically, every company's secrets, all of its most vital pieces of intellectual property. You started the interview with a quote from the head of the NSA. When he says this is the greatest transfer of wealth in history, that's what he's talking about.
And Michael, Senator John Kerry, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is saying how China responds to this is going to be central to how they respond to other issues of concern between the two countries. This has been historically done. Americans lifted patents from British factories, the Soviet Union and East Germans stole U.S. computer and chip designs during the Cold War, South Korea steals from Japan and vice versa. So is there thinking that maybe this is just tough luck?
You know, I think that China probably sees it this way. You know, they probably see this as something that's done in order to help China advance and the Chinese economy advance. And, you know, if the U.S. and U.S. companies can't protect their secrets, that's their problem. But that's what makes this case potentially explosive and potentially a pretty big deal in terms of the U.S.-China relationship, is it's coming at a time when there's a lot of accusations of the theft of intellectual property, of company secrets going on, that China is somehow cheating at this great game of global competition. A lot of that's very hard to prove, though. Hacking, you know, is one of the difficulties is you can see that stuff is stolen, but it's very difficult to tell who stole it. Maybe you can get back to some command and control servers back in China, but who sits ultimately at the keyboard? who knows? What's fascinating, and I think in some ways unique about this case, is that there is a long trail of evidence. Because it dealt with an insider, and because that insider handed in a company computer that had a long trail of evidence, he thought that he had erased it, but it's very difficult, in fact, to clean a hard drive completely. When American Superconductor did this investigation, they were able to recover thousands of messages. Hundreds of them dealt, in fact, with the theft of the code. One of them was an email that had the source code attached to the email and was sent to a Sinovel employee. There's a good deal of, as John Kerry points out, smoking gun evidence in this case. And I think that that's why this case has risen to the level it has, because it's hard to deny that the theft took place. It's hard to deny its significance. And the question now for both American Superconductor, for Sinovel, for both China and the United States is, what do they do with that? Does China make this an example of how they're willing to crack down on this kind of theft? Or do they try and protect Sinovel, which, after all, is one of the largest wind power companies in the world and, in fact, is a very significant player in the Chinese economy?
Well, and why don't they do a third thing, which is create their own technology? You quote the CEO of the American company, Daniel McGann, as saying, gee, I thought we had a symbiotic relationship, China's low manufacturing cost coupled with Western technology. I'm sure no one thinks that that equation is going to last. You know, you do the low-paid, dirty factory work and we'll have the technology. Why hasn't this equation changed? Why are they so reliant still on American technology?
Economists would say that China right now is in a transition. They're moving from an economy that over the last 20 years has been built on making other people's stuff. You know, they make the iPad, they make the iPhone. A lot of companies are building things, assembling things in China because of the availability of cheap labor. China, though, has a much more long-term plan. They want to move from what is essentially an assembly of other people's stuff kind of economy to one that innovates, one that has companies that are leaders in sectors, that are competitive on a global level. That's not an easy thing to do, though. It's taken, you know, the advanced post-industrial economies, the U.S. and Europe, decades, hundreds of years, and often to get to that point. China wants to accelerate that process and do it in 2 to 3 decades. One of their plans, though, is to move to a point where they've got technology that they can build, but there's this possibility that there's a stopgap in the middle where they're stealing other people's technology in order to sort of close the gap, shorten the time frame. I mean, effectively, if you're looking at the big picture from China's point of view, what they're trying to do is boost the economy to a level where it's Chinese companies and Chinese engineers that are making and selling this stuff. And if they're going to push out their American or EU partners to do it, that's just part of the climb.
No. Well, meanwhile, how is the American Superconductor Corporation faring? You know, suing in Chinese courts, lost their biggest client. You've got a CEO who had thought he was a Sinophile. How are they doing?
You know, that's the other thing that makes this case so dramatic, in part because they had grown quickly through this partnership with Sinovel and fallen very quickly after Sinovel pulls out of it. It's a story of a company that comes close to disaster. Right now, American Superconductor is in a phase of rebuilding. One of the things they recognize they need to do is to widen their customer base. They're looking at relationships in India. They're looking at relationships in Russia. They're trying to take the same model that they used in China and go to other places in the world. And they're also hoping to win a substantial amount of money through this legal process in China. They're basically after more than $1 billion in recompense for the theft of its technology. Interestingly enough, Sinovel's in a bit of a tough position as well. I don't think this theft was as well thought out, perhaps, as it should have been. Maybe they never thought they were going to get caught. But the problem now is they've got source code and technology that allows them to run these wind turbine brains themselves. But if they try and export wind turbines with that technology in it, it allows American Superconductor to sue in those venues as well. So it makes it very hard for them to sell on the global market, which is the only place that Sinovel now is going to grow. In fact, one of their biggest and first foreign contracts, one with an Irish wind farm, was canceled right after this theft was made public. And so now they're in a bit of a pinch as well.
Michael Riley of Bloomberg News. To read his story, China Corporate Espionage Boom Knocks Wind Out of U.S. Companies, go to hereandnow.org. Michael, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That 16-year-old Saritha Shirley, a sophomore at Centennial High School in Las Vegas, and the winner of a songwriting contest promoting financial responsibility. It was sponsored by the Charles Schwab Foundation and the Boys and Girls Clubs of America. They asked teens to submit lyrics inspired by a Boys and Girls Club program called Money Matters. Saritha won a cash prize and a trip to Atlanta and had her song and music video produced professionally. You can see it at hereandnow.org. Saritha, congratulations.
Well, thank you.
What did you want to say in your lyrics?
Well, I just want people to learn how to be financially responsible and to know that just because you wear stuff that everybody else is wearing, that doesn't mean that you're fashion, because I see that a lot at my school. Everybody thinks, oh, I'm wearing the next new thing, so I'm cool or something. No, that doesn't make you cool. That makes you like everybody else.
Well, I guess you're talking also about buying that thing. You're trying to tell young people, be careful when you buy.
Yes, be careful, because one minute you may want something and the next week you may not even wear it. So you need to be careful what you buy and think twice about it.
Well, I understand part of the way you got this thinking is through this Money Matters course that you took through the Boys and Girls Clubs there in Las Vegas. What are some of the things you learned?
Through the Money Matters curriculum, I learned that the difference between your needs and your wants and how to be financially responsible and just all sorts of things involving money management.
Well, tell me more. Like, do you keep a checking account?
I do. I do have a checking account, and I have a debit card that I don't have to use a credit card. I just use a debit. I feel that a credit card is more of emergency.
Right. And you have some extra money to put in your checking account and your debit card account, don't you?
I do, and I'm so excited about that.
How much did you win?
I won $500.
Well, this is pretty terrific, in particular because... Do we understand that you were raised largely by your grandma?
Yeah, most people don't know that. I was raised by my grandmother. I grew up in a struggle. But that is the reason why I became independent and started saving my money, because I knew what it was like not to have anything or have money. So that kind of forced me or motivated me to start to do things on my own.
What are some of the things that you've done to raise money?
When I was at home, I used to braid hair. I used to sell candy at school. And I used to babysit, and I still babysit. I'll do most of the good things you could think of that you could possibly do to make money so that I don't have to ask anyone for everything. That is my goal, is to be so independent that I don't have to ask anyone for anything.
Well, as you say in your song, debit, no credit, and my checks don't bounce.
That happens to be my favorite verse.
Well, a survey last year from the investment firm Charles Schwab, as we said, the Charles Schwab Foundation is behind the course you took, they found that 86% of 16 to 18-year-olds would rather learn about money management in a class than make financial mistakes later. Are you finding that? I mean, are your friends interested in money management?
My friends, maybe, but I can't speak for everyone. I know that my friends want to save their money just as bad as I do. But I'm sure that most teens do not know about that, because maybe they're depending on their parents to do things for them and, worried about what their mom or their dad is going to give them. I'm thinking ahead, about what I should do for my future. I try to not to think about, what I want now. I need to think about what I need. And most teens don't do that because they're caught up in the hype and what everybody else is doing. And that's just the opposite of me.
Yeah. What, do you know what you want to do?
Yes, I do know what I want to do. I want to save all my money as much as I can to go to college. USC is what I'm aiming for, but if that doesn't work out, then just a good college, for psychology. That's what I want to do. I love helping people. My music career, I would like to pursue that also, because I feel like through music, you can do music therapy,
Yep.
Because through music, you can help someone, because I've been helped through music myself. I can also do that through my book that I'm writing, and it's called The Sound of My Teardrops. Because I just love helping people. That's my passion, helping.
Wow. Saritha Shirley from Centennial High School. Scared of you. Congratulations again.
Thank you. Money, 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 money all around. Hey. Gotta get some money. This is how it's going down.
American military officials are doing damage control again after another incident that could raise the price tag for the American withdrawal from Afghanistan. Today, the Los Angeles Times published gruesome photos taken 2 years ago showing grinning U.S. soldiers posing with the remains of insurgent suicide bombers. The pictures were given to the paper by a soldier from the 82nd Airborne who told the Times that they point to a breakdown of leadership and discipline. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says an investigation is underway and that the pictures don't represent the values of the vast majority of troops, which of course sounds familiar. In January, a video surfaced on the internet showing Marines urinating on Afghan corpses. In February, the accidental burning of Korans on a U.S. base triggered riots that left more than 24 people dead. And in March, 17 Afghans were killed. An army sergeant has been charged with premeditated murder. And these events come as Afghan President Hamid Karzai is looking for a firmer financial commitment from the U.S. for funds for the cash-strapped Afghan army after the U.S. withdraws combat forces in 2 years. Let's check in with Bing West, retired Marine captain and a former Assistant Secretary of Defense. So, Bing, in your mind, do these pictures raise the price tag of withdrawal?
Yes. But the overall observation I'd make is that any time you go to war and you have over 100,000 people out there, and in this particular battalion they had 35 killed by these improvised explosives, you are going to have individual breakdowns of one degree or another. The big difference today versus any of the other wars is the immediacy with which, because of the digital communications, anything that happens all the way down to a private suddenly is seen all the way around the world. Yeah. It's not that they're performing worse than in the past. If anything, I'd argue they're performing better. But it's a digital age. That's the huge difference.
And it's getting around. Well, you and I were talking before we started here, and my dad had little scalloped edge pictures from Guadalcanal, which were pretty horrific. He wasn't smiling in them. But as you say, this has happened over the course of war. Now these pictures get out faster. But you did just say that you think it will be leverage for the Afghan government as they negotiate the cost of ending this war. The U.S. and Afghanistan forming a strategic partnership agreement. U.S. officials say it's just a framework, but President Karzai wants a written commitment that the U.S. will spend at least $2 billion a year on training Afghan forces going forward. U.S. officials say they expect to spend more than that, maybe $4 billion, but it seems like they don't want to put it in writing. Is that because it is going to get hard to get Congress to approve these payments years out from now?
Absolutely. And that's what happened in Vietnam that we don't want to admit to ourselves. Beginning in 1972, we had promised Vietnam something like $2.5 billion a year. By 1975, when South Vietnam fell, we had cut off the aid completely. And so Karzai is very concerned that he has something in writing. However, the President of the United States cannot commit a Congress 3 years from now to what the Congress is going to do. The Congress would never agree to that. So the amount of money is, it's not going to be resolved. The other thing is that President Karzai is gone. His term comes to an end in 2014. So his bargaining leverage is very, very low, which says that the year 2014, 2015, I expect quite a degree of chaos in Afghanistan.
Well, there's that. And then let's look at the now. You were just in Afghanistan, embedded with U.S. Marines. We'll link to your National Review article at herenow.org. Do you think that the U.S. is getting its money's worth from the Afghan military it's helping to train?
From the Afghan army, the answer is yes. From the police, the answer is probably no. The fundamental issue is beyond us. That is, General Allen, who's now in charge over there, has only one mission: get us out and transition to the Afghan army. And the way things are bouncing all over the place in Afghanistan, I think nobody in 2012 can predict what's going to happen in 2015, except for one thing. We're not going to be the ones doing the fighting in 2015. We're coming home.
Just to your assessment, though, of the Afghan army, a U.S. military official had this to say about the Afghan army to Washington Post reporter Greg Jaffe. He said, "We took the best mountain fighters in the world and turned them into a third-rate NATO army." In other words, he didn't have that positive assessment you had of the military.
Well, the only thing I'm saying is, if you look at what General Allen's been trying to do, the number of people he stood up, the number of people he's trained, it's coming along. And they have a natural fighting capability. Will they fight the way we fight when we're not there? Probably not. But it doesn't mean that they won't fight. The interesting thing is, after the Russians pulled out, the Afghan army held its own for a couple more years. And that's basically what Karzai is saying. He's saying, are you going to give us enough money to pay our army after you're gone? And I don't think we can answer that question, because it's a question of how the U.S. Congress looks at it. But we're talking about a very small amount of money. We're talking about the difference between $4 billion and $6 billion.
Imagine that. That's a small amount of money.
I know. What's happened to us when we talk that way, right?
Well, but when should the U.S. be gone? Just this week, Australia's prime minister said she'll start bringing the 1,500 Australian troops home this year. That's a year earlier than expected. Canada, the Netherlands, and France have already pulled their forces out of combat or have sped up withdrawal. You know, something like 70% of Americans have turned against the war in Afghanistan. Should President Obama consider bringing the troops home earlier?
Well, we are. I mean, President Obama this year is bringing home 30,000 troops out of 100,000. What he does in the next year, does he bring 30% home or 40% home? That's a small question versus has he promised he's bringing the vast majority home, and the answer to that is yes. So we're down to a timetable that's pretty much already set in stone.
Well, one last question before we let you go. We saw the attacks in Afghanistan this week. The Taliban claimed credit, but U.S. and Afghan officials blamed the attacks on the Haqqani network, which is based in Pakistan with ties to the Pakistan Secret Service. I mentioned your article in the National Review. We asked another military analyst, Boston University Professor Andrew Basevich, to read it, and he pointed to these sentences that you wrote, that the Pakistani sanctuary is the third vector here. Pakistan supports terrorists in a proxy war in order to control the eventual political outcome in Afghanistan. Conceding a sanctuary to insurgents has historically imperiled any beleaguered government. In other words, you're saying Afghanistan can't afford to concede the sanctuary for the Haqqani network and others to Pakistan, but what can they do? Short of attacking Pakistan, what can they do?
I cannot conceive, if we were having this conversation even a year from now, that we would not have seen a significant strike against Haqqani. I can't predict how it's figured out, but if they don't figure it out, they have a good chance of losing Afghanistan.
Might it involve U.S. drones?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our drone capability with our strikes scares the living daylights out of all the terrorists, and it's one of the reasons that I don't believe you're going to see the terrorists ever again taking over Kabul.
That's Bing West, retired Marine captain. You can read his latest article about the war in Afghanistan at hereandnow.org. Bing, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Author Ron Rash has long been known for his lyrical tales of his native Appalachia, most notably in his best-selling novel, Serena. We also spoke with him about his award-winning collection, Burning Bright, short stories that painted an often grim picture of modern-day Appalachia, beset by poverty, crystal meth addiction, and crime. In his newest book, The Cove, Ron Rash goes back in time to a North Carolina in the waning days of World War I. A wounded veteran, Hank, and his sister, Laurel, are trying to revive the family farm in The Cove, a cabin hard by cliffs that cut off light and outsiders. As Laurel's mom tells her, a gloomy place.
Nothing but shadow land, her mother had told Laurel. Claimed there wasn't a gloomier place in the whole Blue Ridge. A cursed place as well, most people in the county believed. Cursed long before Laurel's father bought the land. The Cherokee had stayed away from the cove, and the first white family to settle here had all died of smallpox. There were stories of hunters who'd come into the cove and never been seen again, a place where ghosts and fetches wandered.
Ron Rash, reading from his novel, The Cove. Both The Cove and Laurel seem cursed. She seems like the slowly disappearing North Carolina parakeet. Her neighbors think she's a witch, but when Laurel finds a mute stranger on their property, there seems to be the possibility of happiness. Author Ron Rash joins us from WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Ron, good to talk to you again.
Good to be back on again.
What a great read. And I want to ask you first about the language. We just heard some of it. Fetches. We heard of fetches. And in reading, we hear about ash grates and poppet dolls. And here's one sentence. He's not got the sand to do that. How much fun was it for you to go back into this language?
I love doing that. And I was fortunate in some ways that I grew up hearing a lot of that language from my older relatives. But I also love to do research on particularly regional dialects, not just Appalachia, but it was a delight to go back and to find the poetry in the, you know, the folk language.
And before you flash us back to this sort of World War I era story, you begin with a 1950s era TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority official, telling people that we realize in this same area that they have to leave, that this area is going to be flooded. What were you trying to say with that? You know, this story's disappearing. The people are disappearing.
Yes, I feel sometimes that works on the level of a complete culture disappearing. Because actually in my first novel, One Foot in Eden, I had a flooding. I mean, it dealt more directly with the flooding, but just that erasure of a culture and a time and place.
Yeah. Well, tell us about that time and place. Laurel and her brother, they meet Walter. It's revealed to the reader, if not to Laurel and Hank, that Walter was on a ship, the Vaterland, am I saying that
right,
correct?
Yeah.
Which docked in New York during this time, just before World War I. And you have a note in the acknowledgments that says that you researched that ship. So were Germans really on board this ship, and then Germans like Walter really arrested and interned in a camp in Hot Springs when the war started?
Incredibly, yes. And as I started doing more research on it, I thought, if I can't make an interesting novel out of this, I'd better give up, because it was, in many ways, if I had written it as fiction, no one would believe it. But, the Vaterland was actually in New York Harbor for 3 years, and the German crew, this was before the United States declared war, or joined the war, you know, declared war against Germany, and these men were free to go. They would attend operas. They would do German fundraisers.
Well, and yet when the war breaks out, the men were arrested, detained in Hot Springs of all places. Walter breaks out, makes his way to the cove, and doesn't speak because, of course, then it would be revealed that he's German. And so begins our story with Laurel. Tell us more about Laurel. She does seem, well, she is literally blighted. She has a birthmark. And she feels a little bit like these birds that are also characters. Tell us more about that.
I agree. Like the Carolina parakeet, a bird that was actually, a lot of people don't realize that in the Appalachian Mountains, there was this beautiful parakeet called the Carolina parakeet, and they were just dying out at that time. And Laurel is a character who, one thing I wanted to try to do in this novel was to go with the idea of landscape as destiny. I've always been fascinated with the idea of how the landscape that one grows up in affects his or her psychology or the perception of the world. And for Laurel, being in this dark cove, it seems to me that this, the impact of that is that she's struggling so hard to find some light.
Yeah. Well, and maybe there's something, too, that's universal but also maybe particular to Appalachia. This idea of people living in such poverty, such darkness, that there's almost a mystical about them, but not in a good way, you know, in a way that makes people almost afraid of them.
Well, particularly in this novel, I believe that's the case. At the same time, though, I hope the reader senses that, as Emily Dickinson once said, tell the truth, but tell it slant, that the superstition, the fear, all of that ties into the idea of, as we see with Chauncey Fife, the idea of the, you know, anti-German hysteria at that time. And also, I hope the reader senses a connection to what's happening in the United States today.
Well, yeah, there's a fear of the other. Chauncey Fife is a full of himself army recruiter, just a few degrees of consciousness from realizing what a fraud he is. You know, he's avoided the battlefield, but he's the self-assigned policeman who's going to decide who is patriotic and who's not, from college professors to librarians.
I wanted Chauncey to be a character that the reader at first might see as merely a buffoon. To me, one of the most frightening aspects of history is how these people, Idi Amin, Goebbels, people that at first are not taken very seriously or seen almost in a comic way, can, once given the opportunity, cause great harm. And Chauncey, to me, embodies that kind of character that we've seen in the world and continue to see.
Well, we mentioned the Tennessee Valley Authority worker 40 years later. He pulls up a bucket from a well. Now, we now know that's the well in the cove. In that bucket is a skull. So we know right at the beginning of the book, not everyone's making it through this. We're not going to give anything away, but not everyone makes it through this. What's it like to kill off a character?
Oh, it's very painful. I've had people come up to me and say, why did you do this to this particular character? And my answer is, I didn't want to. I feel bad about it, too. But, the story dictates it. And particularly this story, I think the reader senses pretty early on that all is not going to be well by the time we get to the end.
And just, the Cove itself, we began by saying that you like this idea of cultures being flooded, metaphorically, landscape as destiny. Are you talking, too, about losing places like the Cove, these dark, gloomy, mysterious places, as well as the people that live there?
In some ways, and I also wanted this book to feel like a dark fairy tale, and I hope the reader, feels that as well. But one thing I do hope to do in my work, and I think this is one aspect that art does very well, is to preserve a culture that is disappearing. And certainly one thing I hope to do in the book was to give a sense of the language, the folkways, and the culture of my part of the world, which is Western North Carolina.
Author Ron Rash, his novel of World War I Appalachia in North Carolina is The Cove. Ron Rash, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.